Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
When the sun finally shines on the west end of Glasgow, we should have known that this was going to be an absolute busker of an interview, but we didn't. We knew beforehand. Neil and Martin and I selected Charlie Nicholas because we were convinced that this was a guy, very famous now for Soccer Saturday, who'd been a footballer of tremendous creativity and quality, showing some of the skill and cheekiness and ambition that used to characterise the Scottish game and doesn't anymore. So what we wanted to do in this hour and 20 minutes that you're about to listen to was unearth not only what it was growing up in Maryhill that made Charlie so gifted on the ball and able to do things that others weren't able to do, what made him such an instinctive scorer, who steered him, but we wanted to know about his life experiences. The people who crop up in this, you'd probably expect. George Graham pops up, Graham Ricks, Liam Brady, Danny McGrain at great length. If you're a Celtic fan, I'm an Aberdeen fan, and Charlie's time at Pittodrie was glorious, but if you're a Celtic fan, Danny McGrain's role in Charlie's life will enchant you. But Steve Burtonshaw crops up, John Cartwright crops up, people you wouldn't have expected. It's possible that you wouldn't have expected Ron Atkinson's role over the dinner table in Charlie's decision-making process. He talks with love about football because, like me, he's still head over heels in love with the beauty of this game. If you've come out of this podcast interview without thinking more about Charlie as a man of football, I'll be deeply surprised. Sit back, get on your running machine, turn the engine, commute to work, whatever it is you do, listen to it, and just soak this up. One of the best, most enjoyable interviews I've ever been lucky enough to have. What anybody who's listened to these podcasts before Charlie knows is that I'm a little bit over-passionate about football. I get kind of boyish. I don't look like a boy anymore, but football still completely makes me a romantic. I'm head over heels in love with it, and moving to Spain has fueled that a little bit. Yeah. But there's no question in my eyes that even before you made the best decision of your life and became a dandy for a couple of years and won Aberdeen a couple of trophies, watching you, I think particularly at Celtic in the first phase, but in some of the successes you had in England with Arsenal, made me feel the same way as I now feel about some of the players that I admire in Spain. Mm-hmm. Because it was about natural skill, really brilliant natural skill and cheek and creativity and something that made us all really excited to watch football. So I'm going to start this podcast by asking you about a mystery, mm-hmm. a detective mystery. And it's the mystery of Johan Cruyff's shirt. As a non-Celtic fan, one of the first performances of yours that really enraptured me was you not quite single-handedly putting Ajax, Johan Cruyff playing for Ajax, out of Europe. But I believe our last podcast with David Moyes, and he made a grab for Johan Cruyff's shirt and didn't get near it. So who got it, you or George McCluskey, or who got Cruyff's shirt in 1982 when Ajax were knocked out of the European Cup?
I'll start the story with the format of who got it, and it was George Toby McCluskey. As you recall, I mean, he's my all-time favourite European player, Johan Cruyff, too. When I was young and getting brought up in the Celtic tradition, which was about being creative, and or you went the other way, just physically you were trying to fit in a system, and I never really understood systems. I just wanted to play the way I seen people. So ultimate hero was Dalglish. And then overall, you look at the foreign players who, in the old days, in my concept, we only got, sometimes got the one draw. So you go home and away, and it could be Juventus, could be Ajax, could be somebody pretty easy. So the concept of Europe was, all you ever did was read about these guys in magazines. And Cruyff was the one that always caught my attention. Skinny, unpredictable, the Cruyff turn. I love footballers who have been, who have created something different in football. It makes me fall back in my chair and say, wow. You think sometimes it's a boyish, a stupid thing to still be in love with the game. I'm like that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't like everybody coming up to my restaurant and having to talk about football because I do it for a living. But when I talk about people like me who love the game so much, you do tend to fall back into your youth. But with that time with Cruyff, they absolutely battered us at Glasgow Celtic. And we drew 2-2 in the first leg. Cruyff was genius that night because he just came in and kept feeding it to Jesper Olsen. I was getting marked by Jan Mobe, later of Liverpool. Vandenberg was a big player at the time for them. And everything we did, we couldn't get to him quick enough. And Danny McGrain was, for me, the greatest Celtic player in my lifetime. Danny had started to say, we have to try and make inroads. So we got away from Glasgow at home, 2-2, and we thought, it's never going to happen. And Billy McNeil wasn't a great tactician. A great man, Caesar himself. Yeah. But he simply said a few things to us going out at the old stadium in Amsterdam. Was, we're already out, so go for it. Why not go for it? And of course, I've scored, and George McCluskey scores later on. But if you remember, Graham Sinclair was one of your guys, and he had nailed Johan Cruyff on a few occasions. So Johan, because his age, eventually had enough. He couldn't take any more kicking.
At this stage, he's 37, 38,
he's
isn't he?
He's 37, 38. But, I mean, Graham Sinclair was just specifically there to destroy him. And what a soft gentleman he is, actually, off the pitch. But he couldn't believe that he actually was getting the grace to behold one of the greatest of all time. Anyway, he nailed him. He gets taken off about 15, 20 minutes to go. And we sneak through. But as you go round the old inside of the stadium, Johan Cruyff is on a treatment table. Oh, yeah. And I went by and I heard Nicholas getting shouted. And I kind of paused. So I put my head back round and I just got, well played. You played really well. Congratulations, good luck. The Ajax shirt came away. So I got the Ajax shirt and put it down my Celtic top and slowly went in. And I was probably last in, but this time most of the boys were in the shower. And of course, everybody's, who got it, who got it, who got it? And there was a few quiet. I was quiet, I ducked in my bag. Danny McGrain looked at me and went, and I went,
clocked that.
Right, a thumbs up, wink, thinking I've got it. And then, of course, when we got back to the hotel, George showed the number 14. And I opened mine up just to clarify, and it was like 32 or something like that. It was just a known number. But it was just the fact that I got a word. He said a word was more than enough. That was worth 10 shots.
For him to seek you out and say, well played.
Well, I don't think he was seeking me out. I think it was just one of those moments when I'm by. And for him to acknowledge, and I think he was always, maybe this is part of the greatness of what I, and probably you love about Barcelona, we talk about humility, is that there is a way to lose. And the concept of how he's always had that. Mm-hmm. From then, I also always said to myself, I'll never ever admit, even if there's a better one, that there's a better one in him because of the way that he went about the business.
He is an extraordinary man. It's been a privilege of being over there, sent by UEFA, where when they were celebrating 50 years, I think, of the European Cup, they sent me to his house. We went in there. And amongst, it was about a 45-minute interview, and one of the things was he still contends, absolutely, that it wasn't any big deal to lose the World Cup final because it showed the world a brand of football that, because we didn't have wall-to-wall television then, there was no YouTube, no internet, that the world could learn about how that style was attractive, that people could copy it. Maybe he's kidding himself one, but all these years later, he still believed that the greater good of football had been served even by losing, which I think is an extraordinary statement. Like, you might have found somebody saying afterwards, we should have won, or Germany were lucky, or that, you know, the furore in the German press about the wives in our social before the final affected us, whatever. Pound for pound, he's the most important man football's ever had, if you think about him as a director, a coach, and a footballer, and I'm still impacted by him as much as you are now.
Mm-hmm. I still find him a fascination. Every documentary or anything comes on and I hear that he's on it, I have to listen. And going way back when they do the greatest teams ever now and Ajax is on, and how his other teammates talk about him, that he's such a strong influence, even at 23, 24, he had a strong influence to say, no, we have to play this way, and I'll sacrifice something if I have to, but it has to be done for the right reasons. And to keep portraying that without ever winning the greatest prize ever, and to be so close to it. The European Cup at that time was as big as it probably ever was for any. Champions League is massive now, you know, but and a different financial package and everything. But for World Cup, and for the way that the Dutch team had this philosophy that was changing the dynamics of European football, was extraordinary.
I think he called you out when he was on the treatment table for another reason too, because you kind of underplayed the goal. And I wouldn't mind just walking through your goal. Right? You scored in both legs. Your opening goal was a gem, an absolute gem. Describe it.
We were doing a warm-up and it was the old wooden frame goalpost. And I can't remember all the Ajax team's names now, and the keeper in particular. But when we do warm-ups, I always try to take myself with Pat Bonner, who was our goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. The last 5 minutes we were warm-up or so, I would always try and do something different, bending the ball or outside of my foot. And I was very two-footed. A lot of people didn't actually really notice it, but I was actually a better striker of the ball with my left when I finished. I worked in that, particularly just before we went on the field. And we were doing some bits and pieces, and there was a chip packy a couple of times. And goalkeepers don't take it pleasantly. And he says to me, this is on tonight. He said, you could chip this goalkeeper. He's not very tall. It's definitely on tonight. It's actually quite a similar goal to Archie Gemmell's against Holland in the World Cup. McGarvey was in a little bit of trouble, as Frank always was. He was looked as if he was spinning and drilling for oil, because he was spinning. No one could read where he was going to pass or whatever. But he was a great partner for me because he was a grafter. And it just came away in tight situations. And I was more European that way. I was, the challenge of a tighter situation was something that I always thought the Europeans had that we didn't. And I used to particularly work in that in training. There was a couple of little nutmegs in there, a bit similar to Archie Gemmell. And then suddenly I was in about 18-yard box. I could just glance and see the keeper just coming into my vision. And as he did, I just chipped it with my left foot. And as soon as I hit it, I knew it was in. And I just started running and didn't look at the ball. I already knew it was over him. And it was a punt. It was an old terrace and it had no steps, just smooth, but coming down the hill. And there was one Celtic fan who did the aeroplane run all the way down, and he went in the angled run by the time I got to the corner, and I just saluted him. That's probably the greatest goal I've ever scored. Not a lot of people have seen it because of Dutch TV.
It was only on Dutch TV, and having seen it, you know, I'll swear that Cruyff recognised a wee touch of genius, because you've gone across at least four players, taken a back heel into your stride, cut left past another defender, and as you say, left foot to the keeper's top right hand corner. It's absolutely glorious. You've inspired me to ask you something that fascinates me, because in life people talk about nature and nurture. Are you born a way or are you taught to be? Mm-hmm. At what stage did you realise how comfortable you were with the ball? And was it just something you went, oh my God, look what I can do with the ball, or did somebody tell you what to do?
No, I kind of practised. I was a bored child because I just wanted the ball and a pair of boots. My dad and my mum tried their best to obviously supply that. Hard working class, Mary Hall upbringing. I was born in the city in Glasgow. But we moved there when we were four because it was renovations. So we moved up to Maryhill. One of my great friends was James Duffy, who never quite made it at Celtic, but had a half-decent career in Scotland, now Morton manager.
Elegant player. Elegant.
He was a very... But James was very tough. And James actually became like my bodyguard in a way, because I always played with older guys. James was 3 years older and always played with older guys. They loved to kick me because I was more skillful than them. And James was always encouraging me to say, don't ever give that up, don't give it up. So I would go and practice on my own and my little playpen and try little things, because that's how I got over boredom. Kids find other reasons to do it, but that's how I got mine. The more they kicked me, the more I realised I had to, in quick situations and tight situations, be able to move myself from getting hit. It took me a lot of bruises and a lot of cuts to eventually get through that phase. After about a year or so of playing with these older guys, I could move myself very quickly in and out of situations with only just getting a trip. Or I think it was really that upbringing.
Are we talking about Red Blaze, or are we talking about streets? Are we talking about
We're talking about everything. We're talking about red ash on grass. We weren't allowed in this grass pitch because they used to call them the untouchables, used to come and chase us. And we were too young to get the nick, but they would just run us off. There was always somebody complaining. But it was typical of working class areas. Because they had a bit of grass, it was so precious to them.
I mean, who'd let football and grass for heaven's sake? I mean, get off that grass, will you, with that round thing.
Exactly.
So, stupid, that'll never work.
So we used to jib ourselves on, as we would say, get ourselves on there, yeah. And then wait in the vans coming round, and we'd all flee. They knew where we lived, so it wasn't a hassle.
You know, this is something that I think anybody of, we're a similar age, although we don't look it. In Scotland, we grew up not only playing like that, all of us, every minute, every space, but we watched players who could do the things I mean, presumably, like me, you'd have grown up knowing immediately about Willie Henderson or Jimmy Johnson, and you played with Gordon Strachan, who could do things that are similar to what you're describing there. But as I grew into journalism and travelled Europe, it seemed to be the Dutch were really keen on this street football, and Bergkamp talks this day about exactly what you said, having to know about space, having the tricks to avoid having your legs battered on cobblestones or whatever. So you learn your tricks like that, but you leave it behind. And you led me to something I wanted to ask you anyway, because I go and watch Spanish football every weekend, and one of the guys who's obviously impacted me most would be Messi and Iniesta. And now I'm conscious that although I truly despise what Sepp Blatter's done with football while he's been in charge, I'm not a hypocrite. During his mandate, players of your size and stature and ability have been protected. Mm-hmm. Whereas, okay, it was worse than the 70s, but you weren't in the 80s, I don't think. What was it like as a striker when you've gone off the street, there's a referee, there are cameras?
Yeah.
Were you still booted from pillar to post at Celtic and then at Arsenal?
Yeah, I was. I think maybe in a way, a lesser extent at Arsenal. Football in England was going through a strange change from the long ball percentage football, where I think the guy Charles Hughes and others were having a big influence. John Cartwright, who eventually came to Arsenal, which was an absolute disaster for me. But the Celtic thing was different, I think, in a way, because at that time Aberdeen were becoming very strong. We had lots of good players. But when I was 16 in the under-18s at Celtic, Aberdeen had a great under-18s team. Some of them were in the under-18 national team with me. Dundee United were the same. Rangers were the left-behinds. But the three of us as groups, we had an absolute great batch of proper talented footballers, good physical footballers. There was lots of combinations. So it was a really, really bright future at that time. We were all kind of competing against each other at under-18 in the reserves. I remember playing Aberdeen reserves and Billy McNeil and the whole gang coming up with us. And it was two-leg FA League Cup final. And Aberdeen beat us, I think they beat us 3-0, 3-1 in Pittodrie. And Fergie was in the press the next day saying, it was a great game, but how his boys are much better than us. And we came back and Fergie came down for the second leg and Billy was there because they two were competitive against each other, as you well know.
Had been all their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And we beat them 5-1 to win the cup. That competition was there from under-18s. We all as Aberdeen boys and Dundee United boys. So all we were doing was trying to move our game on to a level that was always trying to make you better than what, you know, the lads at John Hewitt was, or, you know, the lads at Dundee United was Ralph Millen and Richard Goff was coming through, Maurice Malpass. So all that intensity of finding the route to how you played and getting kicked. In training, Billy McNeil would purposely put me against Rory McDonald, who was a big brute, a 6'2" centre-half, who could header the ball further than he could kick it, but he could kick me just as far. So he knew if I could accept that and take it, as soon as I went into the first team, I'd be ready.
You got so much kicking that it was imperative that you got used to it on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. I used to have shin guards in my calves. I was the first one to ever do it.
You mean that, don't you? Yeah. You're not joking.
No, honestly, I got to the stage that I didn't. My shin pads, I reverted to the back of my legs because you were allowed to tackle from behind then. And that's where I was getting all my batterings from. If you get somebody face up, it wasn't an issue for me. If I get kicked, I get kicked.
You take the risk. You can also see it coming to the next time.
Well, you do, because you're not waiting it, because I'm usually going left to right. So the angle of the challenge doesn't really get me full on. We had to start working that out, how I was going to do that. And Danny McGrain was kind of my guru. I was speaking to him about it, and it wasn't like the old plastic shin, but it was like cloth with just a little bit of, like the fish tails you get. They were a little bit heavy, but they weren't overly protected. But I just put them back to front, round to my calf, and they helped protect me a little bit. Those little things like that work. But again, Dalglish was probably the best that I ever seen, taking it to your feet and spinning. George McCluskey was really, really good at it. George was a wee bit more timid. Kenny could take the kick, but Kenny could always kick you back. I never really could get that philosophy in my head because my timing was typical striker. I couldn't do it. I wasn't tough enough. Kenny was. And George was more timid than me, so he didn't always like the physical side, but he was brilliant at it. So I kind of worked away at that for a number of seasons to get it right.
See, I remember bumped into him at the golf course a week ago, Neil Cooper.
All right.
Alec, in one game when you were the brilliant young star at Celtic, sent Neil, wound him up all week, didn't he? Famously to say, get that child in it, let's get that child in it. So Neil is a doer. I mean, he was a very, very, very good footballer. I think that's underestimated too. And then I think a Youth World Cup, he was player of the tournament. But that day he went for you like a train. Now, and put you up in the air within about 5 or 6 seconds of the kick-off, would it be?
Yeah.
Now, things like that, not that single incident, that must have driven you to distraction.
It wasn't pleasant. The crazy thing was it happened to me the week before. We played St Mirren at home and we took kick-off. And I was never one for turning and passing it back. If you gave me the ball in front of me, which kick-off is about, I want to go forward. If I can't go forward, then I'm looking for Davy Proven on my right or Tommy Burns on my left. What's the point of passing it back 40 yards when you already have it in the halfway line? Do you do that if you're attacking? So I never believed in that.
I hear the echoes of Barcelona and I hear the echoes of Cruyff and well, I'm full of approval.
I just thought, if you're giving me the ball and you're asking me to pass it back 40 yards, why are you giving me the ball?
Speak to John Cartwright. I'm happy with that.
It's just never got to me. So little Lex Richardson was the culprit at far St Mirren, who was a very experienced player. And he came diving in and my bag of tricks was, I love nutmegs. And I nutmegged him and he took me out. And he took me out and he said, you better not do that again. And I thought, I will do it again. But the fact is, he made a statement of intention to me to say, if you try and take the mickey out of me, I'll hit you. But I said, well, it was only 5 seconds into the game, so it wasn't as if I'd been taking the mickey out of you. He just had it in his head, he was going to nail me if he could. And of course, the following week against Aberdeen, which was an enormous game, because Aberdeen were magical at coming and getting results in Glasgow, we're in. And Fergie knew how to play the crowd, he knew how to play, I'm not saying he knew how to play us, but he knew where our weaknesses were and he was very, very bright. That was a different one altogether because this was a real big, big, big game because it was us two that really, Dundee United were very good, but Aberdeen and Celtic were the best two teams in the country. And when that hit me like that, and there was no action, no yellow card, no nothing. It's quite dramatic because the boys were very quickly onto it because they'd seen it the week before. And of course, my guru, Danny McGrain, was over, referee. And Neil was still kicking me 30 minutes later and still hadn't been yellow carded. And that's what gets into your head. And all of a sudden, Aberdeen score. The little petty lip comes out a bit and you're like, an injustice. And, you know, this is unfair. And I think after that match, Billy had went mad to the media saying that I don't get any protection and it's an absolute joke. If we want to hound him out of the Scottish game. Made a statement on that. Didn't make any difference, really, because it's the way Scottish football was at the time. But it did get to me. But in a strange way, I interviewed Alex Ferguson, a sit-down last year in Glasgow, and we still talk about it. Mm. And when he was my manager at the World Cup in 86, we spoke about it. And I don't bear any grudges. I'm not a really that type of character. But in a strange way, the fact that you mention it tells me there was something within me that terrified them, that they had to go to that cost to do it. So it's the stupidest and funniest way round to give him a compliment, but I'll take it as that.
That's very grown up, I have to say. You stressed that there was a slight difference at Arsenal or in English football. Was that because the refereeing was different? Was that because Arsenal weren't for meddling with? Was that because increasingly you had a Tony Adams or you had a Rocastle by your side? Or what was the difference?
No, the difference was style. The style of play. Arsenal were a back-to-front football team. I wasn't a back-to-front footballer. David Leary, when Tony Adams came in the team, before him we bought Tommy Caton, God rest him, who was going to be a big star at Manchester City. Lovely pass for the ball, great left foot. Kenny Sansom, left back. Viv Anderson hadn't arrived at the time. Pat Jennings in goal. Graham Ricks, absolutely magnificent footballer.
Wonderful footballer.
Magic talent. Tony Woodcock, my partner up front. And Davy Rocky Rocastle, who was my wee pal when he came in the team. So we had lovely footballers, but we would train 5 days a week with Don Howe, who's as good a coach as I've ever worked with.
Don Howe had just taken over from Terry Neill, who'd signed you, right?
Yeah. As good a coach I've ever worked with.
Very clever man, eh?
Very, and lovely man.
Yeah.
But as soon as it came to picking the team on a Saturday, the tactics were gone, the coaching was gone. It was security at the back, and then get it and knock it forward and play from there. Most of my time, my interest in football was, I like to come to feet. I wasn't quick over 30 yards, but I was quick over 5-10 yards. So that would get me a couple of yards if I wanted to pivot into the corners. As us Scots were taught to start inside to work outside. The Europeans start wider to come inside, and that's what makes them the geniuses and us the clowns. But to take it back to that, I like to come to feet to get it in and then link up with midfield players. I spent 60 minutes most games watching the ball fly over my head, back and forward.
Looking for a second ball, looking for a knockdown, little but pieces, nothing to feet.
anything piece-wise, just little pieces, yeah. And I had to live off scraps. A starvation diet, whereas at Celtic, they overfed me because they wanted to get them on the ball. Whereas at Arsenal, they don't have that. They just go, get the ball forward, get it out of your defence and get it up there. Because they were trying to build again the club. And I could understand that, but you can't have 7 international footballers and you don't have a balance and you don't have a shape that you work on to take you to where the international footballers want to be, which is a go and win football match, not want to lose football matches. For about 18 months of that, 2 years, that was a real difficult bite in my lip time. I couldn't work in that environment. But after about 18 months, we brought in Paul Mariner and he dropped me to the so-called number 10 position. We didn't have the triangles or Christmas tree formations then, but it was a little triangle that I played behind. And it worked a treat for about 3-4 months. And we were top of the league after about 7-8 games. We'd just beaten Liverpool. And I spoke to King Kenny Dalglish after the game. And he says, that's the best user I've been for a long time. And you're playing the right position now. We then played next 2 games and we lost them. I got dropped out and he went back to his philosophy again. And that was just a hardship of realising, but it was nothing else to do other than that's the style of play Arsenal wanted and they would not change it until eventually Wenger came in.
The Arsenal experience, I think, has been overly focused on the fact that there was a deluge of goals for you at Celtic and you were a player in command of his surroundings, you were adored. And like Larsson subsequently at Celtic, the ball was given to Larsson when he moved because his movement was brilliant. The ball was given to you because they knew that you would take it, hold it, and that you would do something with it. And at Arsenal, it was almost like, if you want a Charlie Nicholas, why are you playing like this? And if you're playing like this, why have you bought Charlie Nicholas? It seems to me. But there were some really fantastic moments. I remember rooting for you as a Scot, waiting for them to understand the talent that they bought. And I look back on it and I see runs of games where you'd maybe beat and you'd score sequentially against Liverpool, beating them, winning 1-0 at Man United, mm-hmm. back against Jesper Olsen, mm-hmm. scoring against QPR the next week, 3 big games in a row, you're scoring all the time, feeling this is it, it's going to take off. But looking at the quality of the side around you and thinking it wasn't that brilliant an 11 or a 14 maybe, as well as a negative tactics, and you came to Arsenal at a time that wasn't meant for you and you could have fitted and played in the Wenger era, for example. Mm-hmm. I think in Bergkamp's role or Ian Wright's role.
I love Arsenal. I'm more passionate about Arsenal than any other club because they treated me well. They were great people. It was the wrong choice at the wrong time. Liverpool, Spurs, Man United, Inter Milan were all there for me. I spoke to Liverpool a few occasions. Kenny and Souness were kept in. You have to come, you're perfect for us. Brilliant. Kenny says, you'll take over my position. And I said, no, I won't, because you'll play another 4 or 5 seasons.
That's an incredible statement.
Mm-hmm. It was, and it was mind-blowing to hear the King of Kings saying that to me. But I got very close to him and Souness, and they kept saying to me, no, you'll be fine, you'll fit in. You won't be sitting on the bench like a lot of Liverpool signers do. But I couldn't trust that. I could trust my ability, but I couldn't trust the prospect that I might have to sit on the bench. When at 21, I just want out. I just want to play. Where can I play? I didn't want to go to Milan because I think the game would have been too defensive and too structured for me at 21.
No doubt.
Also, the lifestyle thing would have been quite a turnaround for me because I'm a Glasgow social boy. And at 21 then, I still wanted to have a bit of a life.
It was a very brutal league still. It was a really brutal league.
It was. And there were so many talented technical players that had gone there and struggled. Yeah. And I thought, no, if it does happen, maybe 4-5 years down the line, fair enough. Yeah. When you're big enough to take it. But so for me, it was always going to be England. I met Man United, who I did think at first I probably would be drawn to. My dad was in the newspaper industry, worked at Express most of his life, and then he got paid off, and he was in between jobs, and they were offered a role in Manchester. And my dad said, maybe there's something significant that you will eventually move to Manchester. But I didn't particularly like Ron Atkinson.
Without going over the score, I'm applauding deliberately because all flash and no substance. A man I don't have a lot of admiration for, and you wouldn't have enjoyed playing for.
Well, no, I doubt it. I mean, he wasn't a particularly good conversationist because it was very much about him. But we were sitting with Martin Edwards over a steak dinner, and we were with an international team, and Jockstein had let me go for dinner with him. It was steak and chips. The 3 steak and chips came. Ron went into his shirt and messed about with something and then brought this kind of medallion out. I thought, what's he got, a knife and fork in there or something? I mean, what it was, he'd finished his dinner And he had a little, it was like a little cross thing, but he hit a button at the top of it, and this toothpick came out. And he started scraping his teeth. And I thought, oh my God, am I seriously? I could not play for a man like you.
No.
That's absolutely ridiculous. And I could not wait to get out of the restaurant to get away. But Martin Edwards had to take me back. So it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen in my life.
It's so out of kilter with a club built by Matt Busby. So out of kilter with a club that then later supported Alex Ferguson when he needed time to show that intelligence and brilliance. And unfortunately, a colleague of ours, Terry Gibson, a fantastic lad, ended up playing for Ron and found him deceitful and a coward and addicted to sunbeds during training sessions when he's working.
I think Ron was probably addicted to himself in many ways, and that addiction was that whatever he said went. Now, I know a lot of guys who work with him who think he's a really nice guy, good character, and some are very complimentary. I take people as a fine. And that one meeting I had with Ron, it was all about Ron.
That's one choice that, in that moment, was a good choice to make because the click probably wouldn't have been there and you were put off him. But if I'm not wrong, you went to Danny McGrain, apart from an unbelievable defender, great reader of the game, and in an era when we were chock full of world-class players, he was the one in world selects. People kept saying, well, if there's a Scottish player outside Dalglish who gets in a world 11, it's Danny McGrain, at least until his injury, which is so, you know, so difficult and debilitating. But you went to him for advice, if I'm not wrong. You actually said, or he came to you and...
Well,
is that right or am I wrong?
No, you're right in the substance of it, but it started way before that. When I was 16 and I was a car mechanic, I was ready to do my qualifications at high school. I had no real interest in school. I'd lost the will to be educated in that framework because at that time there was a small recession in Scotland again and people were struggling for jobs. And at the time it was like, if any of the kids can go and get anything at all in the market, if you can get a trade. So fortunately, one of my teammates at Celtic Boys Club was a guy called Tommy Coakley, whose dad was a boxing promoter with Jim Watt. And they owned Citroen franchise in George's Cross. And Eddie had said to me after training one night, look, I've got a position if you want to join us. And I said to my mum, and she was panicking because football was probably not a prospect.
Yeah.
Whereas my dad was probably a bit more inclined to believe that it was there. And my mum said, no, I want you to take it. So I went with my mum's decision on that. I didn't turn up for my O-levels at that time.
But at that stage in the Scottish education system, you could get out of school at about 15, couldn't you?
Yeah. I have a birthday right at the turn of New Year on 30th of December, so I'm in between that awkward time. But anyway, the Celtic players used to come in and get some Citroens and things, and then eventually I trained two nights a week. And then eventually I was asked within 4 months by Billy McNeil, who had just taken over from Jock, to come in and do a two-week trial. So Eddie Coakley, my boss, had said, get in there.
Yeah.
We'll give you the 2 weeks off, on you go. So on the second day I was there, Danny McGrain came in and I was like a bit shaky with Danny.
Understandably.
And he says, where do you come from? I says, oh, Maryhill Barracks. He said, I pass by there every morning. How do you get in? And I said, oh, I get the bus, I get the 61 and then I walk around the back, I can jump off, get the 64. He said, well, if I'm going by at such and such, is that too late for you to come in? Now, I later joined the ground staff, but I wasn't on the ground staff for that 2 weeks, although I did a little bit of work after training. So Danny used to bring me in. Which I remember waiting, thinking, he'll forget that I'm here. And I'm sitting outside this wee pub called The Politician, which is right obviously at the barracks entrance. And all my mates are going by and they're, you know, all right, wee man, what are you waiting on? Who are you waiting on? I'm like,
how'd you say
Danny
it?
McGrain. What? And sure enough, Danny turns up.
Fantastic.
In you come. And he picked me up every day I was there. So ever since that, Danny always picked me up. And then there was one time Danny took me back to his house with a bit of lunch, and he showed me some footage of Dalglish and him. Mm. Oh, I just thought it was the most brilliantest thing. I remember sitting there at night trying to work out, why did he show me that? There must be a reason he showed me that. So I don't like keeping too many things in. I like to get it out. So I asked him the next day, why the hell did you show me that? And he says, because I think you're ready for it. Now, I didn't know later on, but David Proven, my great pilot's guy, later tells me that when Celtic were struggling getting bad results, and I was in the reserve team, they were having team meetings and Billy McNeil was saying to George McCluskey in front of me, it's not good enough, it's not good enough. And he would say to Danny, his team captain, what have you got to say? He said, the solution is next door. He's staring you in the face.
Whoa.
And I don't know why you don't get him in. And I wasn't aware of this, but this went on for, by all accounts, 4 or 5 months. So Danny became my kind of guru. And whenever I had anything to ask, he was protocol.
Full of experience, level-headed, Celtic through and through, and unbeknownst to you, saying to the manager, a legend himself,
play this. How the hell he never left Celtic, because everybody wanted him.
Yeah.
Diabetes, fractured skull, broken shin. I watched him coming back from the broken ankle and played Rangers reserves. John McDonald's an up-and-coming star at Rangers, and they beat us 7-1. Me and my boys in the ground staff, we were all Danny McGrain fanatics. And we were, the palms of our hands were all sweating, worrying about him. And within 3 months, he was back in the team, back to his brilliant best. He was the most remarkable individual.
Have I described it correctly? Because I'm describing my growing up memories of him, that it was about his tackling, his judgment, his reading of situations. It felt to me, you know, principally I admired him more for Scotland than for Celtic, but it felt like he was one of these defenders who could change the tone or tempo of a game, because he'd break up what seemed to be floods of attacks, take it, give it to somebody, and suddenly, you know, a 10-second gap might become a 30-second gap when you're on the attack, and if you were being flooded before, then it stopped. He seemed to be an enormous football man beyond... You wouldn't even classify him as a fullback. No. He seemed to be more to him
than that. He was far more than that. He was very much an all-rounder. Even when he got older, he eventually had Davy Proben, who was a great working winger, great cross of the ball. Davy supplied a lot of goals for me. But Davy all liked to do his shift coming back, and it was quite unusual to get that. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was flicks.
I do the clever things.
Yeah, and one-twos. And, but Davy did the other side, the hard yards, as we called it. So he was brilliant for Danny and that, but they two never really always go on. They would fall out all the time. Danny would say, yeah, you've done really well, but he would fall out with you just as quick. So, you know, it was a reality of standard of where he played. And at Scotland, at one stage, he was the best left-back we had. And every other right-back only got in because he could play left-back. So he was the most amazing character, Danny. And to still be floating about, for me, is something to achieve. But I just find that... There's certain glows, you know, like we all want to meet heroes. Remember listening to Kenny Glush's first ever voice interview? I thought, that doesn't sound like my hero. It just sounded weird. Lots of big name people that I've met in my life. John McEnroe, who I loved as a sportsman. But standing up in those, and then you meet really greats, the Beckenbauers and all these type of people. Cruyffs. But Danny McGrain is right up there with anybody I've ever met.
Well, you've given me a nice little gap here to admit that, you know, I started in hospital radio Paisley. And a pal of mine, Damon Quigley, sadly died very, very young, Celtic fanatic, said, come and do hospital radio plays. And I did, just as soon as leaving uni. And one day out of cheek, I was an Aberdeen fan, not long, I mean, a couple of months after you joined Aberdeen, I wrote to the club and said, listen, I'd like to interview Ty Nicholas for hospital radio Paisley. And somehow or another, that got translated into a worthwhile project for you and the club to okay. And you breezed into, it's not picking... You're outside the barracks, but you breezed into the reception at Pittodrie, off the back of training, young and full of energy, and you just turned our club into a football playing side again. And it walked up to me with my little tiny tape recorder. All right, Gray? And I thought, I'm made. That's me for life. If I never do another interview. The patients around the Paisley and Renfrewshire area, they got a beauty of an interview that day. So that's my equivalent.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Meeting a hero. I'm glad Danny's been talked about in that way, because as well as wanting to talk to the audience in this podcast about you beyond your television personality, because for younger people, they see you as a star of Soccer Saturday. And it's good to talk about Danny and explain to people, not just the footballer, but the man too. And if we're getting a little bit romantic about the past, can I tease out a little bit about life at Highbury, the stadium, from you? Because I've cheated because before we turned the tape on, I checked that you felt the same way, and you do. When I first came there as a reporter, having been lucky enough that Glasgow Walter Smith had, you know, taken me into the inside of Ibrox and had lunch there, Tommy Burns had shown me around Parkhead, and because we'd travelled to Turin together to study events, and he came back, I saw his office, I saw Celtic from the inside, which is a real privilege in Hampden too. But the first time I saw Highbury, it installed itself as my second favourite stadium after Pittodrie, because it struck me as like the Downton Abbey of football. It was just aristocratic. And I'd like to know what it felt like moving there, what the standards were like at Highbury, the stadium, what your experiences were there.
The true beauty of Highbury for me wasn't just in the fact that it was a cranky old stadium with the clock end in particular, and the aspect that it only took 37,000, 38,000 people. But there was something extraordinary about it, and I think it adds to it, because at Arsenal we never trained there. We only trained there on a Friday. I found that incredibly weird, because when I went to Celtic Park, going to get changed, we'd all have to get in, not with our own cars, but we'd share cars up to Barrowfield, our training facility, which was 1 mile up the road. And we were covered in mud coming back in these cars. Most ridiculous thing. Surely we must have a team bus or something that takes us up and back. Or when we were filthy dirty, and it was pouring through the heavens in Glasgow, as it always was, some of us would run down the road. Because I was a boy and I used to train up there with Celtic Boys Club, I used to jump on the bus. It's only two stops, the 64. And my granny actually stayed across the road. So I kind of knew the bus drivers and everything. So we would be running along. There was about seven or eight of us. And before I got my metal studs on, and I'd jump on, I'd wave the bus, and they'd go, "Oh, how you doing, boys? All right." And just drop us off the bottom of Kerrydale Street. That's the type of things I always found were adaptable.
I've spoken to Iniesta and Messi and Xavi, and I can guarantee they never quite had this experience. But they might have been the better for it, but yeah. These are different times.
Possibly not. What? Possibly not. But, I mean, the type of thing. And I found going to Highbury was like, that special day on a Friday, we never trained in the pitch. Very rarely did we train in the pitch. It was be the indoor facility. And then in the pitch, we'd maybe just walk through a couple of moves. But as soon as you come down that tunnel, the dress rooms are unbelievable. Just lovely, big, spacious dress rooms. The marble, heated flooring, as people say. The pegs were virtually in the top of the roof. You had to step up to try and reach the peg. Kenny Sansom could hardly ever reach his peg. He was so small. And we used to always play games with that. But I loved the whole concept of how the atmosphere worked at Highbury. I mean, I was very fortunate because I was a very popular individual with the crowd. The North Bank liked me, Clock End liked me. Be a few in between that didn't, who were a bit more precious, a bit more precise about how they wanted certain players. But that's the aspects of the game. But the tunnel, there was a halfway house down, and as you come down that long tunnel, for people who will recall the Vieira Roy Keane incident, when the two of them are head to head, which is a dramatic and fabulous
piece.
Just halfway, 5-10 yards back up, is the little players' lounge. That used to be a players' lounge up there. And we used to invite every away team. And we would pay for the bar, and they could bring their friends and family and all that in there. So we had a lovely little social, maybe too social at times. Highbury for me was just an instinctive love of what incorporated this old historic building that had seen some great players. I didn't really know the full history of Arsenal, but when I was there, the Joe Bakers and these type of players who had been Scottish and played in England and had good reputations, but Arsenal's pedigree of what it really was, it was known as quite aloof, but yet there was a bit of everything within our group. Irish, there was a few Welsh boys, and of course, very few Scots. I was only one there at the time. But I loved the whole experience. I turning up at Highbury on the bus and walking in, and the doorman with a proper regalia and the whole thing, coming in there, old Pete.
And it's gone now. That's the sad thing, but you played a part in its farewell, which I didn't know.
Well, I'm still a pretty hardcore Celtic fan. I've kind of lost a fabric of my spirit for it because of the way the club's run now. It's not the Celtic that I was kind of brought up with. And I'm adaptable. I know there's modern ways. I don't have a problem with that. I still wish the team every success. But I don't like a lot of what the people who run the current club do. And they're not very good at remembering a lot of the ex-players. I was standing up for some ex-players for a while that they were getting benefit dinners, and these guys who were on 50, 60 grand a week were getting benefit dinners. And I'm saying, well, what about Tommy Callaghan and all these different players that didn't get it? Dennis Corhan was mentioned. A lot of these guys are ill and not well, and at least pay for an operation. And they don't like all that type of talk. But I don't care. I'll put my neck on the line sometimes for the rights of what I believe in. So they don't really look after, I'm not just saying me, but a lot of other ex-players that well. Whereas Arsenal invited me and my daughter to watch Arsenal's last European tie at Highbury against Juventus. Vieira was coming back. Henri was just probably just becoming the best Arsenal player I'd ever seen, if not becoming the best player in the Premier League that I'd ever seen. And Fabregas was just bubbling through in the background. And I was invited on the pitch before kickoff, when they were warming up, two or three questions. Everything, they gave me a Nicholas shirt again, gave my daughter a Nicholas shirt.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And then we went back in and we were asked, we Frankie Dettori is an Arsenal fan, but he's mainly a Juventus fan. And the three is all signed the wall. But I asked them and said, would you mind if my daughter Nadine was to sign the wall? And they said, absolutely no problem. It'd be an absolute pleasure. See, and that's the club for me.
But your anecdote supports this idea, because image and reality, which I introduced, and I'm not being particularly mean about Ron Atkinson, but that was my problem about image and reality. And image and reality in football usually don't collide, they don't intersect. There are a lot of things in football where you'd like to believe in them, you believe in them, and then you're let down. But Arsenal has this lifelong reputation about things should be done correctly, that there are standards, that there are attitudes, and if Spurs fans are thrown up at the moment, this isn't, for me, an Arsenal fanboy. It is their reputation. To see that fulfilled, to see that they thought well of you and remembered, because you might have expected me when you went down maybe to have more trophies and more goals. But I was going to leave this until later, but I'm on Twitter, and there's a fella called Stephen Headley, who, when he found out you were on this, and I think this sums up what you talked about the fans in you, he said, I'm looking forward to hearing Bonnie Prince Charlie, a talent win at Arsenal. Boy, was he great. Maybe London was too big for the lad at that time. Dalglish might have been better for him, but I'm glad I saw him in an Arsenal shirt. I mean, I think if you leave a legacy like that in your career, and the club treat you well and they bring you back, then it's a statement about how you played. Mm-hmm. Before we leave Arsenal, do you have any memories? I think everyone knows you scored the winning goals against Liverpool in the League Cup final in 87. But my memory is that the semi-final was utterly epic. The semi-final was three games against Spurs, and they seemed to be some of the most dramatic football. I can't remember if I watched them live, but my memory, my lying memory at this age, at my age, tells me I watched them all, that they're all live, and maybe not all of them were. But do you remember the sequence of games, the three games against Spurs?
The two of them were actually in the Cup, because it was a two-leg affair, and we'd played them just before that in the league, actually.
I didn't know that.
What happened was that, in my time, we'd always beaten Spurs. And I think that was part of the fabric I was getting a bit extra love, because my record against them was pretty good. But at that time, we were just starting to change, because George Graham is now our manager. And talking about another subject player, but Glenn Hoddle was as good as I've ever seen. He was never English. He should have been one of us. But
and there was a little splinter of him in Chrissy Waddle in that side as well.
Yeah.
And little Ozzy Ardiles.
Yeah, they were a really good side. They were good to play against, but they were really good to watch. Yeah. Me and Graham Ricks, if Arsenal played on the Tuesday and Spurs were at home that midweek also, Spurs would play on the Wednesday. That's how they would work the police, so that the games could work. Me and Rixey would go and watch Spurs. We'd get into Spurs.
With protection?
Well, we'd get into a box, because you couldn't take that risk. Yeah. But we'd love to go and see them.
That's impressive.
And Graham Ricks was big pals with Glenn Hoddle because of England internationals. Yeah. But Hoddle that night against us in the first leg, stunning. Absolutely stunning. And they beat us well that night. And going back in the second leg, we still always knew we had a good chance. But we were going out. I'd actually been taken off. I'd struggled in the away game. If I'm correct, I think it was Ian Allinson came on for me, who was a real good runner. And a late guy with pace could help you. And it proved to be the case. But there was 2 minutes to go, and the Spurs announcer says to Spurs fans, the vouchers for the League Cup final will be going on sale after the match. And we heard this during the game.
Whoops.
Yeah, heard it during the game. And we all went, I was on the bench at the time, we all went, what? And 2 minutes later, Ian Allinson scored. And it was the most fantastic feeling you've ever had in your life. Not just because it was a derby and we were through to the final, first final in 8 years for Arsenal, but the way that the fabric had taken place and taken shape.
Yeah.
It was absolutely mad, because it just got caught up in every emotion that we couldn't believe. And George Graham had obviously just came. Because I'd actually played in a London derby, I think it was 2 years before that. And after the game, this is how weird that derbies are. I mean, Celtic and Rangers is... I've never been to El Clasico, and it's the one thing I want in my life before I ever finish.
Standing invitation here on the record, never to be taken back.
Well, I'll be straight on your case this season. But I played in London Derby, I've been to Merseyside Derby, and I've been to Manchester Derby. But there was something weird about London. They say, how hard should it? We finished, we beat Spurs one night, 2-1, at White Hart Lane, and Eamon Andrews came on with "This Is Your Life" for Pat Jennings. I was like, "This is a London derby, Eamon. Fuck it off."
Yeah, honestly, no idea.
Honestly, he did.
That's
he came
extraordinary.
On. Couldn't make this up.
Kind of like special things. I mean, there was a superstar feel about both clubs because although Spurs...
They were the flamboyant club.
They had been winning European trophies, the double still. Well,
yeah.
The North London sides had both won the double, okay, Spurs previously. But when you, I suppose when you have... And not only did they have Hoddle and Waddle and Ardiles, they'd had those run of the Coventry FA Cup finals, Stevie Archibald and the team. They'd stuck to a playing style, which actually would have suited you brilliantly.
I was suited more to Spurs style.
Yeah.
That was a hard thing because when we played Spurs, the good thing is that they opened the game up. You know, they had Tony Galvin on the left. Yep. Stevie Archibald was brilliant from up front. Garth Crooks was very successful for him. But Hoddle, Ardiles in midfield, and they're quite aggressive at the back, you know, Graham Roberts and Stevie Perriman was still playing away, Paul Miller. But they were a very good side, good to watch. But we always knew we had the edge over them because Spurs had this cockiness about it, whereas Arsenal had a restraint on it. It was as if we will agitate us. And that tended to be the situation. And it summed it all up when the announcer says, "Here's the vouchers for your cup final, boys." And we walk away and we say, "No, you won't."
I'm not at all interested in nightlife in this question. I want to know what, for a young, beginning to be relatively well-off Glaswegian, what was the city of London like? What was life in London like in terms of them? The things that would attract all of us about, I don't know, whether it was clothes shopping, whether it was live music, whether it was going to concerts, eating out, or just, I don't know if you're a fan of, I love to, in big cities, see the world go by because the world is the most extraordinary and curious thing. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I'd been to London once in my life and we got battered 5-1 with England, Stuart Kennedy's day. And in those days, my parents ran a bus.
That was you as a fan?
Yeah.
Tartan Army fan?
Yeah. Sadly, it was the time of Bay City Rollers when we all had the Bay City Rollers tartan scarf.
Shang-a-lang.
Yeah, Shang-a-lang and Scooby-Doo and How Do You Do and White Skinners. So, not a happy time. But my parents, who all drank in the local Marehill pubs, decided that they wanted to take the bus and the boys that were old enough would be taken down. And we actually stayed in a hotel in Kensington, which is not too far from where I sometimes live with Sky now. So it's quite a memory when I passed by there. But that's the only time I'd ever been to London. Mm-hmm. Furthest south I ever got for a holiday was I think, Rhyl. So it had nothing to do with cities or anything. It was just the fabric of what Arsenal were telling me they were trying to do to what eventually they did do was different.
Yeah.
They were talking about bringing Brady back from Italy. They were going after Ray Wilkins at Chelsea at the time.
Oh, I'm beginning to understand what that would have supplied your movement with.
The fabric of where they were talking about going was changing the style of the club.
Yeah.
And that's what brought me into the fabric of the club. London itself, for about a year, maybe 15 months, was as lonely as a time as I've ever had. I found that hard to cope with. Mm-hmm. I had a pal who came down for a couple of months who was a joiner. He did a bit of work and then he was a kind of home bird. So he went back to Kilsyth, did his job of work and got on with his life. And then eventually my sister, who I lost last year, she was a massive football fan. And she worked for a legal team. She was a PA. And she came and lived with me for 6 months. Sorry, she had a really good job, well paid. And we lived together. She came to the football, loved her football. And that was a nice time. But I found it hard to try and educate myself into London. It's like you talk about watching the world go by now. I mean, I spend most of my time in Spain in the summer, in Mallorca. But I did 3 days in Madrid 2 weeks ago, just city bus, sitting watching the world go by. I've done Barcelona many times, which is my favourite city. And I love going and seeing all this. But when you're 21 and the invites are coming through the post, there's a party, and here's another party, there's a music party. And I love my music. The one thing I did love more than anything else, other than football, was music. So Haircut were 100, were out, and the Spandau Ballet Boys were across the road in a restaurant, and then you would meet the drummer from Boy George's band to John, who was an Arsenal fan, and you would bump into them, it'd be another party, another party, another party. Now, I was going to these parties maybe on a Tuesday or Wednesday, but they were in the papers on a Saturday morning. So I was nailed, bank your rights, and the gaffer would say to me, "Was you out last night?" "No, I wasn't out last night, I was out Wednesday night, and I've trained 2 days since then, so you know, it's not as if I was out on the lag." I like my drink, but I've also been a fantastic trainer. I've always loved my training. There's no doubt in the old days, because of lack of education and being taught properly, we're at Wenger and all the modern guys do now, is that we overindulged. Of course we did, because that was just something that you weren't...
And at that club, it's established that there was a culture there.
There was a culture there, because again, we weren't... You had to look after yourself. And like now, they've got agents and different guys and are fitness gurus, and they're told and have this and have that. It's a single soft excuse, but it was a reality of life at the time. And when you're 21 and you're lonely and you're trying to make new pals outside your teammates, because I've always thought it was really more important. You train with these guys and you play and you live and die with them. But at the same time, you must have other friends that you can go to that gets you away from it.
To clear your head
of the... You have to have that.
Yeah.
And I always kept that when I was a Glasgow boy. To go to London and nobody, it was like really, really weird. Eventually I did learn how to handle it and meet other people. And had a great time. But the club itself could not have helped me more. In the end, I was going back and saying, look, I'm finding it hard. It's lonely. I don't know what to do. I'm invited to...
That's a smart thing to do. In the west of Scotland, we're not very good at opening up.
Yeah, I can't hold it, and I've never been that type. I just take him out. I don't see any point in holding on to an issue if you can share it with
somebody. You'd agree with me that we don't do that well in this...
No, we don't. In us Scots,
we keep it inside, don't we?
It's hard to be seen, shown, maybe a relatively soft side, but I just always felt that way. And they were helpful, but Paul Marlon was a great help to me. Pat Jennings was a good help.
Good man.
Graham Ricks was a good pal. And Kenny Sansom also was. And it's sad to see like people like Kenny having wee issues now. But all you can do is wish them well. But yeah, it was London at times. I wouldn't have said it was my happiest place. But yeah, see now if you ask me, because I know so much about it.
It's an extraordinary place, isn't it? It's an addictive place. It's like this. I feel when I go there, it's like being in the centre of the world.
Yeah.
And it's exciting, and the history. Like you talked about taking the bus around Barcelona, which when we moved there, we suddenly developed lots of friends who wanted to come. Yeah. We didn't know they were so close to us, and must have been on that bus tour about 20 times in the first 6 months. But now I'll go on the river cruises at the Thames, and its history fascinates me, and Londoners fascinate me, and that would be my favourite city.
I'm the same, because when I go down, like, my Oyster card, and I know I can get the 237 into White City, and
you're
I
know
how
to do buses. It. You're a man.
I'm a man for my buses and my tube. I love to travel that way. I think you learn more. I think you see more. London, as you know, hardly anybody knows
you. See incredible things. Yeah.
You know, I was banned for driving when I first went to Arsenal. So I stayed in Diggs with John Lukic, who was the goalkeeper. So he would drive me to training and drive me back. But if I wanted to go somewhere, John wasn't much out. He was a car freak for Yorkshire, right? So I wanted to go. I would say, well, where's the bus?
How'd you get
making a few bob, but I wasn't wealthy. And I'm not paying 30, 40 quid for a taxi. I'm a Scotsman in there. I don't mind spending my money, but it has to be for the right
reasons. I hear it.
So I like all that. It's always been part of your fabric, watch. And I think you see so much more.
You see the strangest things. And it also makes me happy to see life go by.
Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about atmosphere and the training ground and the dressing room and the unity and whatever. If we skip beyond what I call the glory years at Pittodrie, if we go to, for those who can't see, Charlie is smiling indulgently inside his head, he's saying, stop it. If we could go to Soccer Saturday, I know it's everybody works for a salary, so they pay you to do it. But, and also it's clear that it's a clinically researched show and that Jeff Stelling, the host, is very, very talented. But I have a theory that the fun that the five of you have, but the four ex-pros, does it recreate something that all sportsmen and women lose when they stop competing, is the banter, the nonsense, the digging of the dressing room and the training ground? Is that part of what attracts you four to it as ex-pros? And could it be part of what the audience love, because they know they're seeing something like if you lifted the lid of a good dressing room and you saw all the chat?
We always find it hard to break down. I've never been more popular when I'm in London. You go through the airports and everybody's, what game are you doing today? And you're like, what game are you doing tomorrow? You go through Glasgow. And it's like, they're fascinated by it. We don't quite understand it. We often say it's like being in the pub with your mates, talking about the game without having a beer or a glass of wine. First and foremost, I mean, this is my 18th year of doing this show. I've been with Sky. So I've been there a long time, and I've come through Rodney Marsh, who was very interesting. A very... Very much
colourful and forthright.
Yes, very. It was a very interesting subject. Actually, people always say that there's certain characters I wouldn't get on with, because I've got quite a happy, outgoing personality. But I always seem to get somebody who's quieter, and they don't expect to be my mate. I don't know how it works. They thought Graham Ricks would be a little bit like that with me in England, and he wasn't. Pat Jennings, and he wasn't. You know, invited to dinner on a few occasions by Pat. Wally Miller at Aberdeen, and everybody went, don't ask Wally to go for a pint. Buffalo, are you coming for... And it's just one of those, if you don't ask...
He's quite a hard man, demanding man.
But so you never find out if you don't ask, do you? There's nothing blasé about it. It's just simply, you know, do you find another mate?
Yeah.
And these type of things went on more and more as I was getting older, and just the fabric of a life-changing, I think. And I try to understand what sometimes people see in us in Soccer Saturday. We find each other interesting. We do like to argue with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's not cover-up.
Yeah,
you know, if there's a debate going, it's a genuine debate. My favourite is Phil Thompson, because I've never known a man who's in his 60s be such a kid and so passionate about his club than he is. Tomo and I share a car going back to the airport after the show, and if Liverpool don't win, he doesn't speak to me. he just don't speak to me. And I don't know if it's personal, but I don't take it as. But this is the type of things. Jeff, I, Cammy, in particular, and Tomo, we all meet on a Friday at our hotel. We have a couple of drinks. We don't talk about the show. Mm-hmm. We just talk about life. We talk about families. We talk about anything. Saturday just seems to click. So I don't know. But I would say one thing about it is that we are all blessed as ex-players to be on that show, because we're getting paid for something we dearly love. And of course, if the fans don't see anything and they're still listening to us harbouring on, letting a radio show. But the genius of it all is Jeff. He's a great guy, as much as he's a great presenter. But he's also, for years and years, Graham, I wasn't a big believer in it, but a lot of the guys that I've worked in the media with, I've always said, oh, you're a journalist, so what do you really know about it? And I found that quite weird, because I would think, there's a lot of journalists that I was brought up with who were more social than they are with the modern terms now, that I found very interesting guys and very interesting knowledge of the game, and to read your books, for instance. But the old-fashioned guys, and I always thought, well, hold on a minute, why can't a journalist have no knowledge of football? Who are the new modern concept great managers? Do they play football well? Mm. And it's always proved the point. Jeff has a great knowledge of football because he loves it.
It's a big compliment. I understand that. I mean, he works very hard. It takes his responsibility seriously, which in any walk of life, if you research, if you practice, if you're dedicated to it, then whatever talent you have will come out better. And another thing that I appreciate, although it's a side bet to what you've been talking about, is the wit. There's a lot of wit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of quick minds there. And quick tongues. And I swear again that part of the reason we wanted to do these podcasts is that those of you that we admire, you're very different people than are portrayed on the pitch. Naturally, I mean, again, if you had your doubts about why journalists might not be decent company or might be educated about football, the three of us, Martin and Neil, are here, the guys who came up with this concept. We know that you're not one-dimensional people, that there is a huge amount of variety and wit and interest in footballers who are either just playing, not playing, or on television. And I find that about you, that the four of you convey a side of football that I think we hear about, wit and banter and fun, allied to good, strong points of view about the game. That's a potent mix.
It is very much a kiddie's football and dressing room, and that's what footballers are. We've always had the childish wit. I mean, at Arsenal, I was there 3 months. I wasn't shy when I first went in. I was, you know, why would I be holding back?
No.
Get in there, meet the guys, how you doing? And I was sick to death after 2 months that they kept saying, could you slow down a bit? Could you slow down a bit? Could you slow down? And I just kept going. And eventually I did slow down a little bit. But for 3 months, I kept cutting David Leary's socks. I just kept cutting holes in. And every day, he knew it was me, but he could never catch me. And eventually he would give in. And after 3 months, I've made my impression with him to soften him a bit, to say, you know, I'm here. You can talk to me. I'm approachable. And I became quite pally with him after a while.
I enjoy that and I like it. And I wish that, you know, if I could swap anything, it wouldn't be the millions of the current footballers. It would be the enjoyment of the social bond that if you get in a good dressing room. I've had the good fortune to chance into Football Club Barcelona, which I know you admire, but Spanish football too. I look at the Spain football team, and because of diligence, maybe rather than talent, they've let me in a little bit. They've opened the doors, they've allowed me into dressing rooms, into training camps, into hotels. And what I see about them, both the Spain national team and Barcelona, less so Real Madrid, because Real Madrid tend to chop and change, and the core players, which have been reduced by Casillas, being pushed out. Core players at Real Madrid, it's a smaller number of guys who are there because they've been there for a long time, or they've come through the system of the Madrid fans. So there's a difference between Spain and Barcelona. But I've noticed that how they approach football, how they approach their work, their clear-headedness about what they want to achieve, their bond to each other. These are things that are extraordinary. And I wonder, from a distance, what you most appreciate about what you've seen over the last, let's call it the last 8, 9, 10 years in Spanish football, the national team, or Madrid, or Valencia, or Sevilla, or Barcelona. What are the things that, as a football lover, attract you and turn you on?
I think for the underachievers for so long in Spanish concept, and I hear it a lot in England now, and the FA are all saying, oh, we need a quota of players that we should be in, and the Italians tried it years ago when there can only be three people represented in the team. No country seems to have embraced it better than the Spanish, I mean, the last 10 years. I'm not just talking about Messi, because he's the genius of all geniuses, in my opinion. But it's how they adapt their game philosophy. And I think your intrigue inside that when I read stuff is that somebody like Xavi can have a strong influence within a dressing room, but he has to have somebody above him who believes in that. And I think the Spanish manager proved that he could take that on board. But it really started with Cruyff, and then it was worked in. But he kept the Dutch theme. I mean, Rijkaard wasn't a major success, but it was the right thing for Barca. But it's how they've introduced all the different other styles from all over the world to say, we can make that help us grow as a nation. And I think that's what I've taken on the concept of where they do. Just last week in Mallorca, Del Bosque was doing a coaching session, and with his name on it, he didn't do it, but they had four really good coaches. My nephew was over, so he did 5 days with him, three boys from Stirling. And I only seen one day, but it was tremendously different how they interest that concept of running with the ball. Mm-hmm. When I was brought up in Scotland, the concept of the most exciting players were the guys who ran with the ball. The Spanish have now got that. Why? What have we missed out? We're a smaller nation, I know that, but it's how they adapted to everything and took it straight on the chin and said, we can make this work and be a reality because we have the talent. But if you don't believe in the talent and the short and the frail, the Iniestas of this world, and don't eventually say, now, was it Pep who eventually said, I'm going with it, I've got nothing to worry, or did the Spanish thing as a nation then say, we've finally got, because Aragonés was quite a hard man.
Very, very.
When it comes across to me, and he portrays as a hard man. I love Fabregas. Mm-hmm. He's not everybody's favourite. Mm. I think he'll get a hard time at Chelsea, just because he's probably still an Arsenal fan. But the real greats, the Iniestas and the Xavis and the real little add-ons, they say, some people in our countries would say, oh, I get 600 passes, but they don't really go anywhere. Well, they're going to go somewhere eventually, aren't they? Mm-hmm. They're going to go to better players. Mm-hmm. They're going to go to guys who, when I was younger, would say, can you give me maybe 100 a day passes, Mr. Xavi? So I just love the whole thing that they've seen a reality, worked on what comes to their country, and said, we can make this work for us.
You've neatly done a loop, because you talked about them not having faith in you after a few good games at Arsenal where there was a couple of bad results. And you're pinpointing there twice that Pep Guardiola had to have faith in restoring the passing game, had to have faith that Messi could be brought in and put in a centre-forward position, even though he's pocket-sized. Luis Aragonés saying, I have total faith in Xavi, that 3 years ago I was saying, get the ball quickly, fast, powerful, we can never play passing football. He comes in, he sees them, and he has faith in them because I've changed my mind completely. I want to build everything around you. Is that the key element that this it doesn't explain everything, but that this conversation is based on, that nurture talent, but when you find it, have faith. Danny had, I mean, there's another theme. You know, this guy who, if people were misinformed about Danny, they might say he was a destroyer, that he broke games down because he was a very good tackler, he's a defender. But he had the vision enough to say to Billy McNeil, trust this young fella. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're taking out of this conversation, of trust and faith?
Well, it's my version of it. My version of it is that if you look at and train me players and you see that there's two or three better than the rest of the group, predominantly those players will be creative, advanced players. Why would you want to waste them? Mm. I want to see them. I would want to say, well, they're my best players for a reason, so they should play. Not they're my most average players, or he can run quicker, or he's stronger. That can come. You can't add a little bit to that. But if I have got a perception of football the way I see it, the way that I've listened to Cruyff and the guys that I like to speak about and listen to, then I could only go with the philosophy for me, which is if they are better than other players in your group, then you have to play them. And that tends to always be the creative players. We still have a lot of talent in Scotland, as in kids. I know they've got other aspects of they can walk away from football and they've got too many other games to play and different things. And we do it at the lower levels in Scotland still. We will sub the skillful guy to get the runner on. And it becomes a desperate plan. So you'll never trust the creative side. But I just love the whole mentality, what Barcelona have done, has said to Spain and other managers, you might not always like this tiki-taka or whatever you want to call it, But if you believe in it and we know how to work it, it can be a success.
This is no advert for me to Sky, for whom, you know, I don't work, I'm just a freelance when they bring me in. It's nice. I fervently believe that for the quality of football in England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, the fact that Sky have been pumping La Liga into our living rooms for 19 years will gradually have an effect on how coaches that make those wrong substitutions, or coaches who develop our players, or youngsters who, like, I'm being told one thing by my teacher or my coach, but I know, I've seen it on television. I know how, not just Barcelona and Real Madrid play, but I know how Valencia play and how Sevilla play. And I know that I admire those with technique, and whether it's Valeron or whether it's Pique can control the ball and play it beautifully as a defender. That's what I think Spanish football will give us, a legacy. It's like an injection of talent. We're going to close because I've taken about a day of your time. The sun's still up.
It's only a day.
It's tanning weather in the west end of Glasgow. But if you'll indulge me, just the League Cup final against Rangers, Aberdeen, your part in our glory, the memories of that era, and why the hell you went back to a side that did nothing but kick you for about 10 years as a junior or a reserve and a first team player.
Well, in all honesty,
were we offering an oil rig? Did we offer an oil rig?
If only. If I was to get one, Wally Miller was getting the same deal.
No, two. Definitely
yeah,
two.
Yeah. In all honesty, I didn't really look that I was interested in going back to Aberdeen. The reason being, I always felt that the right thing for me was eventually Europe.
Yeah.
And I'd went to Toulon, spoken to Toulon in Nice over a fine dinner and nice bottle of wine. We were Arsenal treasurer called Ken Fryer and my agent. And we'd agreed in principle I would go there and play in Toulon. I went back and George Graham and myself. George was into discipline, but he over-exaggerated. You asked for a meeting with George and George was running a mile. He wasn't a disciplinarian. He'd discipline you in front of the players, but not have a meeting with you afterwards, you know. So that was George. So I always asked for a meeting. Brian Clough tried to take me to Notts Forest and Jim Smith was trying to take me to Derby. And George wouldn't have any. He cancelled my deal with Toulon.
Worried about you coming back?
Possibly, but the Toulon thing made sense because I wasn't going to be paying him.
Fair
but
fair comment.
He knew I was going to be living in Nice. It was just like, as if he was so jealous. I'm not letting him go. That's too nice for him. So he kiboshed it and said, oh no, I might use him. Yeah, he kiboshed it and I couldn't believe it. I never got to meet with him afterwards. In fact, I've seen him in Sky a few years later, but I still never spoke to him. But so in the end, I was 3 months into the season. And then he was sending me to Cambridge University with a third team, and I was sitting on the bench, and just ridiculous how he did that. As I say, we never had a conversation, so there's no fallout. And then I just said, I just want to go and play.
Go play.
Right. So I had to see his number two was a guy, Steve Burtonshaw, who was his dealer, in terms of who was in, who was out. He would see who's happy, who's not. And I said, look, I just want to go. I just want out here. And then they blocked those moves, and I'd heard about those moves, and he denied them. And then in December, there was talk about Aberdeen. And I thought, I just need to get I don't want to get out of the club. But I could see that George was building something.
Which was going in maybe in a different
way. And I knew my time had come. And I'm not one for hanging about. It was a conversation with old Dick Donald. It was a stunning old man. Manager was weird. God rest him, Ian Porterfield. He was quite unpredictable, was fieldy.
Yep.
But there's still the history and the fabric of the club. Was still a club of intense interest to me. And more importantly, there was still Leighton Miller and McLeish all there. So the fabric of the club was still with the right people. So I don't think I was ever actually taking a gamble, because the one thing I always wanted to prove if I was coming back, even for a two and a bit year spell, was that I could still win things. And that was the most important thing to me. I did find it hard to adapt in the first 6 months or so. But the turning point for me at Aberdeen was Gilhouse. Gilhouse was just
tremendous,
stunning for me.
Footballer.
Oh, yeah. Tremendous for me. Yeah. Great athlete, nice enough guy, mm-hmm. Quiet, but I could bring out the best in him, and he could bring out the best in me in the field. And it was a career changer, Hans Gilhouse signing for me. It got me back believing in what I was doing was the right things. I was never going to be prolific then, but I was scoring important goals again, and that was the issue of that. But the Rangers win with Paul Mason getting the two goals and me setting them up for the winner, it was a big, big statement for us, because we blew the one the year before when I first came. We should have beat Rangers that day. David Robertson gave away the crazy penalty.
Yeah.
So it could have been three titles, but we should have pushed more for the league. But I was really, really pleased with my time. I built a house in Peter Cooter. I really loved Aberdeen. I settled in well. And the fans took, they always knew I was a Celtic fan. When I scored against it, I never celebrated. But they knew exactly. But the cheer for winning the Scottish Cup when I knew I was leaving was at the town hall was just...
One on penalties.
That was a choker.
Yeah, good.
That was a choker for me.
There's something you've pinpointed there, and I think it's the reason, as we close, that we were desperate. We were so pleased when you said yes, and Neil was chatting to you, which I was quite keen. I was like, the world's turning the wrong way. He should be saying, well, all right, maybe, because this is a treat for us. But I said at the start, and I'll repeat it again, and I'll probably say in the intro when we record it afterwards, you know, it's nice to meet your talent, you know, somebody who improved our lives, you know, because football is as important as breathing in and out. And when you see quality in somebody that you can be proud of and enjoy, whether it's Scotland or Arsenal, Celtic or Aberdeen, it's a real joy. And you said at Arsenal, there were some who maybe were keen on you and some who didn't, but the majority loved you irrespective of the fact that it was one trophy in that time. And at Aberdeen, a Celtic man, doesn't matter. He's ours for the moment and he's good to watch. That's what we try and do in these podcasts. Mm-hmm. People who love the game, people who've been great to watch. Evidently, you still love the game. Great to watch in your day, great to listen to at the moment. I regard this as a privilege.
Well, I take it the same way. I mean, right. I'm still a great believer of the fans are still the most important people in the world of football. And that's what makes us all still smile and love it.
Well, they're listening. A good fair few of them are listening at the moment. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, mate.
Listen, quiet at the back, you. At the end of these, I like to do a little test to make sure that you've been paying attention and not talking over Charles and I. So there was a hint that despite similar birth dates, one of us looks younger and the other older. Who did you think it was? Yeah, me. It was a really enjoyable hour and a bit with a man that I admire and like still more than before we started it. I hope you feel the same way. Now, if you'd like to hear more about the podcasts and get exclusive updates on forthcoming episodes, and I know you do, because you're always asking me on Twitter for that kind of info, then follow at GH Podcast on Twitter. And even more importantly, if you want first shot at the downloads and the interviews, head to grahamhunter.tv and sign up to our mailing list. We'll keep you in touch. Thanks very much to the Hotel Duvan. I want to be careful about not always saying that we're in the most beautiful and glamorous locations, and that's why we've cited this in the West End of Glasgow. But the hotel is utterly exceptional. We've been treated, quite rightly, like royalty. Thank you to Beer Jacket for Snowball, the music that you hear in this. The albums are fantastic. Find Beer Jacket on Bandcamp and listen to it. This podcast is produced by Backpage and by me and edited by Alex Adey. Thanks for being there. Charlie said during the interview that the fans are still the most important people in the game. I hope we're fellow fans of people like Charlie and lives spent like his. See you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.